First of the headlines, President Raisi orders immediate probe into a deadly terrorist attack targeting a shrine in southern Iran, as four suspects are also arrested. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry condemns Israeli settlers' attacks on Bedouin schools, saying such assaults are committed by organized terrorist gangs. China says it will take resolute and forceful measures over a brief visit by Taiwan's VP to the U.S. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian president has instructed authorities to immediately identify and to bring to justice those involved in the Sunday terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz. Ibrahim Raisi also expressed condolences on the tragic incident, which left at least one person dead and several wounded, one critically. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has also strongly condemned the attack. He has warned of a painful end for the perpetrators and supporters. A gunman opened fire at the entrance of the Shah Jarrah shrine on Sunday. He was arrested at the site. Security forces have also detained four suspects over the shooting. The incident is the second of its kind since last October, when another gunman killed 13 people at the shrine. Our correspondent Gisumi Shahmadi earlier gave us more details on the terrorist attack in Shah Jarrah Holy Shrine.
We do have some of the details right now. At first, it was thought that the assailants were two people. We do know that it was one person carrying 240 bullets and eight magazines. So basically, Kaveh, this could have been a lot worse than what it is right now. Not to deny the fact that already what has happened is really tragic and very upsetting for Iranians, something that is totally unacceptable. Once again, in Shah Jarrah Holy Shrine, a religious holy site, which, of course, is of great significance for Iranians. The fact that this is once again being undermined, less than a year after that terrorist attack you just mentioned happened last year, we're seeing this happening. We could look at the bright side and say at least there was only one person killed this time. We do know that several people are in critical condition in hospital, and the number of those killed might increase. And, of course, eight people in total have been injured.
Habiba Jalkhouri is a journalist who joins us from Adelaide over in Australia. Talk about this further. Habiba Jalkhouri, welcome to our program. You know, when you take a look at what has happened here, obviously it's a tragedy. You know, you have terrorists that come inside a country, violate it, and kill innocent people. But what's underestimated in this point is the way that Iran has fought against these terrorists, not only preventing many terrorist attacks that could have happened on a yearly basis, but also what stands at the forefront of this, and that's the inspiration that the late martyr Qasem Soleimani stood in terms of his relevance in the fighting against the Daesh terrorists. First, your impression of the terrorist attack and how Soleimani does play a role on a daily basis, practically, for Iranian security forces to maintain security in the Islamic Republic.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you very much for having me, and salamu alaikum to everyone listening. Yes, you're absolutely right. It is thanks to the efforts and engineering of Sheikh Qasem Soleimani, Sardar Soleimani, that the entire Western world is safe from disgusting and heinous terrorist attacks by Daesh, by ISIS. And unfortunately, Iran has faced many difficulties and has fallen victim to their to the terrorist plots, because Iran represents a system that wants to liberate humankind, whoever you are, whatever religion, whatever gender, whatever skin color, under the banner of freedom, under the banner of liberation, under the banner of justice. And these terrorists, who are the products of agents of corruption, of capitalism, of liberal democracy here in the West, cannot stand that. So these terrorist attacks are attempts to try and confront that, to try and confront the inqilab that Iran has created, the Shuhada have created, and its adherents internationally. And so, of course, the Shah Jarrah attacks is such a heartbreaking tragedy that anywhere in the world it would be condemned, anywhere in the world should be condemned by any reasonable-minded person. However, I would like to note that even BBC has claimed, yes, ISIS came and were responsible for these attacks, and knowing this, Masih Ahmadinejad, who is on CIA's payroll, came and sent her allegiance to these terrorists and said Iran has arrested them, they should be free. And Masih Ahmadinejad and her movement and what they represent, this is what their values are. It's hidden in terrorist attacks. It's hidden in killing innocent lives.
So when you take a look at the bigger context here of the way that Iran should be viewed in terms of its fight against terrorism, it's pretty ironic that Iran is being vilified by the West, in particular by the U.S., who happens to be on, for example, on Syrian soil. This is just an example, with the terrorists not too far away from them, and they've been there for, I think, it's over 7 or 8 years, and these terrorists are still there, and they're not getting rid of it. It's just the, I want to say, the double standards or the hypocrisy of it, I should say, where Iran is vilified by them who are fighting these terrorists, but yet they're there, and it seems, based on the way Iran has indicated their official stance, that U.S. does have a hand, one way or another, covertly or indirectly supporting these terrorists. So doesn't that just show the double standard in this case when it comes to the U.S. vis-a-vis Iran and terrorists?
Of course. Of course, the hypocrisy is so blatant. It is an extreme double standard. They're the reason why all these Western countries, they're the reason why their state apparatus, the media, and their armies have all come out against Iran with one story, and that is that Iran is this country that needs to be abolished. The regime needs to be abolished. It is all propaganda, and it is all for that one reason, that Iran is the sole country in the world that is fighting against their agendas in the Middle East, in the Global South. And these people have created and funded the terrorists to come and create instability and to just try and overthrow Iran's divine system, Iran's revolution. These people are the opposite of revolutionary. They only want to enslave humans and exploit humans for their own profit and agenda. It is a complete hypocrisy. There's a reason why so much is being invested, billions of dollars, through media, through propaganda, celebrities, influencers, anyone, their politicians have come out. U.S. administration officials have come out blatantly in the past and have admitted, yeah, we funded ISIS, we created the Taliban. This is what the Clinton family have admitted to. This is what Mike Pompeo has admitted to. He said, we lied, we stole, and we invaded. They've said it.
All right. Thank you so much for that, Habiba Jaghoori, journalist there from Adelaide, Australia. Pleasure. Moving on, the death toll from the Hawaii wildfires has risen to 93 amid growing anger over the response to the deadliest U.S. blaze that has occurred in 100 years. Hawaiian authorities say the number of fatalities will increase further as hundreds are still unaccounted for. The fire has damaged or has destroyed more than 2,200 structures in the hardest-hit town of Lahaina. It has also left thousands homeless. Officials have launched an investigation into the handling of the fire as residents are complaining that there had been no warnings. Hawaii Congresswoman Jill Tokuda says officials had underestimated the danger of the devastating fire. The blaze has been described as the worst natural disaster in the island's history. Argentina's ruling coalition is heading for a defeat in the presidential primaries as a far-right outsider emerges as the biggest vote-getter. Anti-establishment Javier Milei is so far in the lead with 32% of the votes. That's out of the 73% of the ballots counted. The candidates of the main conservative bloc and the ruling coalition are trailing him with 28 and 26% of the votes, respectively. Primaries serve as a clear indication of the favorite to win in the October elections. The deeply unpopular president, Alberto Fernandez, is not seeking re-election. That comes amid public outrage with year-on-year inflation at 115%, poverty soaring, and the value of the peso nosediving. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has condemned Israeli settler attacks against Bedouin schools east of the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. The ministry said the attacks fall within the framework of, quote, organized terrorist gangs. The ministry said the assaults are a serious escalation of settlers' attacks against Palestinian educational institutions. According to the statement, the attacks are part of an Israeli plan to Judaize and to annex the West Bank. It says the regime is fully responsible for the violence. On Sunday, Israeli settlers stormed Ras al-Tin and al-Tahari schools and threatened to demolish them. The settlers smashed the school windows and vandalized their contents under the pretext that schools are located in an area under full control of the Israeli regime. Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip are left with seriously contaminated water due to years of Israeli blockade and multiple military attacks in recent years. Ashraf Shannon has the details.
Groundwater pollution has reached an alarming level in the Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants, posing grave risks for Gazans. Israel has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewage systems and targeted them during wars. Water pollution poses serious health risks throughout the tiny coastal sliver.
The Israeli continuous blockade has severe implications on the situation of water in Gaza. 97% of the Gaza aquifer water is polluted due to the destruction happened on the last offensives that we witnessed in Gaza Strip.
More than 2 million Gazans are forced to buy filtered water in order to cook or drink. Tap water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. People only use it for house cleaning and doing the laundry.
Tap water is not suitable for drinking, and I think it's not even good for animals to drink. Tap water makes us sick, and we only use it to wash our clothes and to clean the house. My family spends a lot of money to buy filtered water. We only use filtered water to cook and drink.
Inhumane Israeli practices have taken their toll on the coastal sliver's drinking water. Water contamination levels are at least 3 times higher than the standards of the World Health Organization for safe drinking water.
More than 97% of Gaza's groundwater is polluted and does not meet the standards of the World Health Organization. The blockade and repeated Israeli military operations and the direct targeting of Gaza's vital infrastructure have also caused damage to water systems and affected water supply networks, further exacerbating the already existing water crisis.
The consumption of contaminated water at levels over international safety standards can cause potentially life-threatening diseases.
Years of Israeli siege and multiple wars since 2008 have devastated Gaza's water infrastructure and led to increasing levels of pollution in drinking water supplies. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
China has strongly condemned the U.S. for arranging a visit by Taiwanese Vice President William Lai. Beijing says it will take resolute and forceful measures to safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity. The Chinese Foreign Ministry says Beijing is firmly opposed to any form of official exchanges between the U.S. and Taiwan. It also labeled Lai a downright troublemaker. Lai is a vocal separatist and a candidate in Taiwan's presidential elections next year. He is officially making transit stops in the U.S. en route to and from Paraguay. China claims that Taiwan is its own territory. Washington does not have formal diplomatic relations with the island, but maintains close ties with the territory and is its most important international source of weapons. Geopolitical analyst Peter Koenig tells us how U.S. provocations have been backfiring in Taiwan.
This constant tension and war provocation has prompted already numerous dangerous military maneuvers and exercises in the South China Sea, and Taiwanese people are heavily under stress. I know that personally from various conversations I had with many Taiwanese in this case. What the Biden administration does apparently not realize that this nonstop provocation of Beijing does backfire, because already today, a large proportion of Taiwanese citizens, some say more than half the Taiwanese, this is speculation, wants to integrate as soon as possible into mainland China so as to stop the provocation, the fear from war, from aggression, this stress, which is due only due to U.S. provocations and hassles. What is inevitable, and every U.S. administration knows that, is that Taiwan sooner or later will be integrated peacefully into mainland China. Today already, there are many direct and indirect relations, irreversible relations between Taiwan and China. Business relations, scientific research, joint scientific research, and investments from mainland China in Taiwan and vice versa.
The Niger military junta says it will prosecute deposed President Mohamed Bazoum for high treason and for undermining the country's security. The junta said it has gathered evidence to prosecute Bazoum and his accomplices before the competent national and international bodies. Meanwhile, coup leaders lashed out at the economic community of the West African state, ECOWAS, for imposing sanctions on Niger, calling the measures illegal and inhumane. ECOWAS has been taking numerous measures to reinstate President Bazoum. The regional bloc has given the go-ahead for a military intervention in Niger. This is while an August 6 deadline set by the ECOWAS was ignored by the military junta. Coup leaders say that they are ready for a diplomatic resolution to the standoff with ECOWAS.
Anti-French sentiment runs high in Niger as thousands of people have rallied near a French military base on the outskirts of the capital, Niamey, to call for the withdrawal of the country's forces. Protesters shouted "Down with France" and "Down with ECOWAS" as they surrounded the base. The demonstrators argued that the West African regional bloc is not independent and is being manipulated by France. ECOWAS has given the green light for a military intervention in Niger after it approved the deployment of a standby force as part of its effort to remove Niger military rulers following last month's coup and reinstate deposed pro-Western leader Mohamed Bazoum. The Ivory Coast president says heads of state of the 15-nation bloc have agreed that the operation should start as soon as possible. The president said his country will provide a maximum of 1,100 troops alongside soldiers from Nigeria and Benin. He said other member countries will join them later. France has thrown its full backing to all the conclusions of the West African leaders who met in Nigerian capital Abuja to make the necessary arrangements. The United States has also voiced support for efforts of ECOWAS on Niger.
As significantly, ECOWAS, the organization that brings together West African countries, is playing a lead role in making clear the imperative of the return to constitutional order, and we very much support ECOWAS's leadership and work on this.
The support for ECOWAS efforts come as a deadline set by the regional bloc for Bazoum to be reinstated on August 6th was ignored by Nigerian junta. The junta has moved one step further and announced a new government there. The developments in Niger come nearly 3 weeks after soldiers belonging to the country's presidential guard blockaded access to President Bazoum's residence in Niamey and arrested him. Shortly after the storming of the president's residence, the army led by General Abdurrahman Tiani took control of the country's political leadership there.
And that is for this edition of World News. That's bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. With the UK military seeing 30% decline in regular forces recruits, the country has resorted to review its recruitment policies to allow it to access a wider pool of people, including those suffering from certain neurological conditions like autism. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Financial Times, the British military could review its recruitment policies to allow it to access a wider pool of people, including those suffering from certain neurological conditions. Morrison, who serves as Parliamentary Under Secretary of State for Defence People, Veterans and Service Families, argued that this would help provide the armed forces with the skilled professionals amid chronic staffing shortages. In an interview with Financial Times published recently, Morrison explained that there are pinch points where things are quite serious, adding that the UK military should adopt a more flexible approach toward hiring new personnel. The MP stated that with the armed forces placing increasing emphasis on cyber warfare, it should start casting the net more widely to hire neurodiverse people. According to Morrison, while personnel with dyslexia and dyspraxia are already serving in the British military, the door should now be open to candidates with autism, Asperger's and ADHD. These people may possess skills and attributes which others don't, the lawmaker argued. Morrison also suggested allowing older personnel to continue serving for longer, as there is no philosophical barrier as to why we couldn't look at extending the age of retirement. In June, a government-commissioned analysis revealed that the British military was failing to attract technologically skilled recruits. The NATO Deputy Supreme Allied Commander for Europe, General Tim Radford, also warned last month that London could cease to be a major power within the US-led bloc, as its military is too small. Speaking to the Daily Telegraph, the commander stressed that the modern technology which Britain is betting on cannot fully replace traditional armed forces. Last month, a survey of British military personnel conducted between September 2022 and February 2023 indicated that only 42% of troops were satisfied with service life. Among the main grievances highlighted by the poll were poor housing conditions and low wages. Commenting on the state of affairs in the British military, Defence Secretary Ben Wallace acknowledged back in January that it was hollowed out and underfunded. According to the website of Army Technology, newly released figures show near total reductions across the board for the UK military as recruitment and retention rates fall amid a worsening economic decline. The strength of the UK armed forces dropped by 3.3% between October 1, 2021 and October 2022. According to the latest recruitment and retention figures released by the UK government, with just 5,090 people joining the regular forces, a 29.8% decrease registered during the reported period. Releasing the quarterly service personnel statistics on December 15th, the UK government revealed that the total strength of UK forces personnel stood at 192,300 as of October 1st, 2022. This marked a 6,640 decrease in service personnel compared to the same point last year. Further decreases were registered in the full-time trained strength of the Royal Navy, Royal Marines and Royal Air Force, RAF, and the full-time trained strength of the British Army on October 1, 2022, with the figure standing at 134,940, a decrease of 2,190 or 1.6% from October 1, 2021. Recruitment has also registered a steep drop, with 11,982 people joining the UK regular forces in the past 12 months, that is, between October 1, 2021 to September 30, 2022, a decrease of 5,090, that is 29.8%, compared with the previous 12-month period. Tellingly, retention is also suffering, with 16,250 people leaving the UK regular forces between October 1, 2021 and September 30, 2022, or more than 1,300 per month, an increase of 2,400, that is 17.4% compared with the previous 12-month period. Further decreases were registered when comparing the full-time trained strength of the Royal Navy, Royal Marines and RAF, and the full-time trained strength of the British Army at October 1, 2022 of 134,940, a decrease of 2,190, 1.6% from October 1, 2022. Recruitment has also registered a steep drop, with 11,982 people joining the UK regular forces in the past 12 months, a decrease of 5,090 compared with the previous 12-month period.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, across the board, from white-collar workers to blue-collar workers, few seem satisfied with their jobs in the United Kingdom. From railway drivers to ambulance driver to lawyers and doctors, just about everyone is demanding better working conditions and an increase in their salaries. Industrial strikes have become common, but few have had desired results. What's going on in the UK and what is next for the British people? Well, to help me look at all of this, I'd like to welcome my guest to the program. Out of Amsterdam, Steve Keane, economist and author. And Tony Gosling, investigative journalist out of Bristol.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, good to have both of you with me on the program. Let's start off with Steve. Steve, why are we seeing such dissatisfaction across the board with workers in the UK?
I think because the UK has had about 20 to 25 years, actually longer, 40 years, of failed economic and industrial policies with an obsession upon government austerity and also a belief that manufacturing is not a growth area, so they decided to specialise in services. They're empirically completely wrong. Services have never replaced the manufacturing exports Britain used to make. So it's now running chronic trade deficits while the government tries not to spend money. And that is a recipe for a declining amount of money in the economy and a declining amount of jobs. And finally, the working class and middle class, and that includes doctors in the UK, given its national health scheme, are finally saying they've had enough and they're demanding some sort of compensation for the effective cut in their real incomes over the last 30 or 40 years.
Well, Tony, would you say that this all started off around the time of Margaret Thatcher, or your assessment of it all?
Definitely. Steve's absolutely right. 45 years ago, with the advent of Thatcher, she was selling off the family silver. That's what we called it here. And that is the all of the public sector works that have been put in really since the 1930s. And this was a way that the governments, both here and in the United States and other parts of the world, built their way out of the Great Depression, was to spend money, public money, on building infrastructure for the country. And Margaret Thatcher started then selling all of that off. But we've got a big difference going on in the public and the private sector and what's left of the public sector, because that is to say things like hospitals, because that's all in the public sector here in Britain with the National Health Service, just simply hasn't been keeping pace with the private sector. Private sector pay is kind of managing to keep up with inflation, but public sector pay has gone right back, and this is why there's been so much. And of course, at the same time, we've now got Andrew Bailey, the new governor of the Bank of England, is starting to ramp up interest rates. So this is causing even more stress on people's disposable income, particularly, as I just said, for the people in the public sector. This is, rail workers, which is essentially, although it's been partly privatised, it's a government-owned network, and they can do what they want with it, effectively, as well as also the teachers, and now we've seen the junior doctors are simply not able to keep up because their rents and their mortgages are now starting to go up, so their pay is going down. So even the pay awards that they have got in the public sector, the teachers have accepted it, and the nurses, etc., is actually a pay cut. This is, as Steve says, a complete failure of economics, really, and of course aided and abetted by this particular government under Rishi Sunak, who really seems to act rather in the interests of his old bosses at Goldman Sachs than he does in the voters here. Of course, the British voters never voted for him. They voted for Boris. Boris was shunted out of the way, and Goldman Sachs were brought in to take over.
Well, Steve, when we look at the situation, Tony just talked about junior doctors. We have senior doctors that are going on strike in a few more days. It just seems in general that things are in disarray. I mean, when we look at, especially, let's look at physicians and the importance, of course, of their job. And looking at the situation in the UK, one would think that there would be certain professions that at least the government would look at a little bit closer in trying to, for example, right now, especially after the COVID crisis, the nurses and the doctors gave so much of their time, and actually the government thanked them and said what a great job they have done. But at the end of the day, why isn't anything done for the people?
Largely because of the obsession about running government surpluses. which is, it sounds sensible to most people. Most people think you shouldn't spend more than you earn, but that's applying a household way of thinking to a government, where a government actually creates money, and it creates money by spending more than it gets back in taxation. So if you have an obsession with running a surplus instead, and that's dominated British politics for the last 40 years and certainly the last 15 under the recent bunch of Tories, you're actually destroying money and then telling people the economy to grow faster. And the trouble is, unfortunately, the easiest way for the government to not create money is to pay lousy wages to its workers in nationally owned industries. And of course, in the UK, health is nationally owned. So they find it easier to clap and applaud than pay money, when in fact they should do both. And if they did do both, they'd create more money for the private sector, which might enable economic activity in the UK to get off the floor.
Well, Tony, how much of this goes back to a neoliberal agenda? Because if we look at, again, I go back to Thatcher, or, of course, in the States, it was Reagan at the same time. And we see from then on just a drop in the quality of the lives of workers, and as far as benefits and payments. Your take on that, the role in neoliberalism in this?
Look, it's massively important. You're absolutely right. Look, even the Royal Society for Medicine in 2011 came out with a very comprehensive report, which had taken it 2 years to put together, looking at all of the healthcare systems right across the OECD countries, and particularly Europe and the United States. And they found that the British National Health Service was the most cost-effective, the best value, and that's because the profit motive is taken out of the system in a public sector like the National Health Service, which is free at the point of delivery. So this is an extremely effective and extremely efficient, cost-effective, very good value health service we've got. Now, who doesn't like that? Let's have a think. Oh, I tell you who it is. It's the American private health insurance companies, which is an extremely inefficient way and highly expensive way to run a healthcare system. And so they've been eating away. And this is part of neoliberal economics. And let me tell you why it is the doctors have actually gone out on strike finally, after many years of having their pay eroded. And that's because they're looking around them and seeing the doctors, their colleagues, actually just leaving because the pay is so low. These people can go to almost any country abroad and get paid more as a doctor than they can here in Britain. And so they're not doing this for selfish reasons. In other words, they want more money. What they're doing is they're saying, well, unless we go on strike now, there's going to be nothing left of this health service. And indeed, we've seen the figures for waiting lists, waiting times in Britain escalate over the period of COVID. Obviously, they went up. But they've never come down. They've been continuing to go up since then. And we're now at roughly 1 in 10 people in Britain is waiting for a important, possibly life-saving operation. And the waiting list is now up to over 7.5 million people now waiting for an operation, waiting for a procedure, because there simply aren't enough doctors, because the health service is hemorrhaging this staff. Now, of course, this is a tactic of neoliberal economics, as I'm sure Steve will agree. You've got to destroy the opposition, however good it is. Otherwise, you can't get your high profit motive healthcare system into the country.
Well, Steve, does it make a difference in the British government if Labour is in power or the Conservatives are in power? You've been talking about, and Tony, been talking about 40 years. So in 40 years, we've had governments from Labour. We've had them from both parties. Does it make a difference at the end of the day who is actually in power?
It does make a small difference, because the way I describe it is the Tories imposed neoliberalism with glee, and the Labour Party imposes neoliberalism with an apology, and is therefore likely to be less extreme in how much it cuts back pay and cuts back services and so on. But it still fundamentally wears the same hat. This, of course, is the Labour Party under Keir Starmer, and the Labour Party is created by Tony Blair rather than the Labour Party as it was in the old days, and as Corbyn tried to make it when he was the leader. So if you share the same ideology, you're going to come out with the same sorts of policies. And it's the ideology which is to blame. And it really is an incompatible ideology to Labour thinking overall. The Labour Party has conned itself to believe this ideology. The Tories believe it because it suits them. It still doesn't make the theory any better, but they at least, in a weird way, benefit. out of the sort of catastrophes that they've imposed upon the public sector in the UK.
Well, Tony, let's talk about the social aspects of this, because the Brits are not the French. I mean, they do not usually protest or demonstrate or even industrial action a lot. Very different. I mean, we look at, I can tell you, being an American, I remember looking at the UK with envy. For example, the higher education at one point in time was free over there that we could not have even imagined in the States. Of course, that was taken away from you guys, and not a whole lot was done. So I want to talk about this part right now, that actually more and more people are taking these industrial actions. For the British, let's talk about that side of things, what it means.
Well, I think in a way the British have got a sort of reserved anarchistic streak in them. People are very independent-minded and they would rather not act, but when they are pushed, and this is one of the things that's so fascinating about the politics here at the moment, is we've got an opposition Labour Party and Keir Starmer, who's part of the Rockefeller Trilateral Commission, which he joined secretly when he was in Jeremy Corbyn's cabinet, by the way. And so what you've got effectively is just Team A and Team B of the same party now. Corbyn was very different. And so we have no real opposition in Parliament. But what we do have is we still have democratic unions. And all of these unions take all these decisions by asking their members at ballots what they want to do. And so that's why I think we've seen the unions kind of replace the Labour Party as a political opposition here in the UK, because they're actually the only section of democratic politics left that actually acts in a democratic fashion. So the leadership is following what the membership wants. So when an offer comes along, the leadership of the union will put that to all its members, and the members will decide when it's potentially going to go out on strike or take industrial action of another sort. This goes out to a ballot. The members decide. And so that's, I think, what one of the most fascinating things about politics here now is the way that the parliament, the mother of parliaments, is in this stranglehold of neoliberal economics on both sides with Team A and Team B. But it's actually the members of the trade unions outside that are now trying to save the public services they work in. As I said, hemorrhaging staff, and it's the only way they can actually stop the teaching professions collapse. I mean, we've got in our universities, you were just talking about, a horrible situation where only people like Amazon and big business can afford to pay for departments and chairs at universities. So the universities are now becoming almost like public relations operations and think tanks for big corporations. They've got very little freedom, academic freedom now. And we've seen various academics literally kicked out of their jobs because they're saying something which upsets the corporate funders of a university. So, you know, you're right. It was a fantastic system here with free higher education about 40 years ago, 30 years ago, in fact. But we're now seeing the corporate takeover of almost everything, even the corporate lobbying of government becoming so powerful that these big corporations can lobby the government. And what we see is a decimation of small and medium businesses with COVID and also with these increased interest rates and rents and this sort of thing. The small and medium businesses are going bust at an incredible rate. Public houses, pubs being shut, a lot of public spaces going over to housing. And this benefits those big corporations, the Amazons, the Microsofts, these big multinationals, because they're so much more powerful at lobbying our government, which is extremely weak.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Steve, why does it seem that there's always money, for example, for war? Or we see now how much money London has been giving to Ukraine. I mean, it seems like everything else is prioritized over the British people. Your take on that?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the usual mantra, how are we going to pay for it, has never applied to buying weapons or sending troops overseas. That's taken on as a duty, something we must do. Of course, the UK has made appalling choices of where it does that over the last 30 or 40 years. But it seems when national security is mentioned, all concepts of budgetary responsibility, so-called, go out the window. In fact, the best security is a healthy society. And that's what's being undermined by all these policies. So, again, it's ideology ruling over logic.
So where do you see that going, Tony? You heard what Steve said, security actually comes about with a society that is more satisfied. Your take on where the UK is going, do you see the situation improving?
Well, no, I don't, because I had a chat to Crispin Flintoff, who he was one of the biggest fundraisers for Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party one of the biggest fundraisers in the whole of the Labour Party's history. And chatting with him as I interviewed him last week, he was saying he believes that the Labour Party will actually be worse for Britain now than the Conservatives, because there is no free speech within the Labour Party. If you have a specific line, if you stray from that line, you're suspended and then removed. Even if you're an MP, a Labour MP, they have very little freedom of speech, very little wriggle room. And of course, if you've got a party like that that's so rigidly controlled, then anything can happen. You know, you just don't know where that party's going to go. And it makes it's very unlike the British to be behaving like that. So that's why I'm very concerned about the way things are going with the general election next year here in Britain, because it looks as if the Conservatives don't want to actually win the general election. I've heard from some inside sources that that they actually want to lose because they know the economy's going to crash, and they would much rather that happened whilst Labour were in power than them, so that Labour gets the blame. This is how cynical I think politics is here now. And so really the people ruling the roost are the big corporations, as I said before. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who are actually calling the shots, I think, and the government is constantly on the back foot, and the people are almost totally forgotten about, where you've got a parliament, most of which of the ruling party and the opposition are simply beholden to the big corporations. So, no, I'm afraid the prospects are pretty grim. The positive thing about that, though, is that maybe the country will run out of money to help the Ukrainians. And I think there is some sort of change of attitude there certainly in the United States and more in Britain too, where people are getting rather fed up with the idea of supporting the Ukrainians. There's certainly no stomach within the British and in the forces for taking the Russians on, because they know that if they take the Russians on directly, that the British will lose. So there may be a bit of rolling back on the support for Ukraine, I hope.
Hmm. Well, Steve, what do you think? I mean, what Tony is saying is basically that the big corporations are ruling. So what would the British people have to do to actually get control of their country again? I mean, it's the same situation that so many of these Western nations are facing today, that the power is actually in the hands of a few. And the majority of people do not support a lot of the policies that these governments are doing. So what does it take in your perspective?
Well, frankly, I'm very pessimistic about what it takes ever actually happening. But fundamentally, we have to realize that neoliberalism and the neoclassical economics in which it's based are a completely false analysis of both human society and a capitalist economy. So we're following a theory which is wrong. If you do what a wrong theory tells you to do, you're bound to make things worse than if you simply STFU and did nothing at all. So in this sense, government policy is actually making capitalism work worse than it would do if they weren't actually trying to manage it, following this false theory. So that's what's necessary. But, you know, we've had 40 years of this, and it's slowly dawning on people that it hasn't worked. But over 40 years, you've lost your manufacturing sector, you've lost your higher education sector in terms of access to people who aren't wealthy. you've lost your health service, et cetera, et cetera. You've got an enormous amount of rebuilding to do. So even if the realization did come that this was a terribly bad way to run an economy, it's been running it for 40 years and it's done a terrible amount of damage, which probably will never be reversed.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that is definitely sad the way you've just said it, Steve. But Tony, what do you think? I mean, is it likely that the situation just will continue to deteriorate, that we would see more widespread strikes or perhaps even more aggressive actions taken by the people? At the end of the day, as we believe, the real power is in the hands of the people if they're united and are working towards a goal. I mean, how do you see it?
Well, okay, so I'm a bit more optimistic than Steve. I mean, certainly when it comes to the general election next year, bad. But after that, the thing is that the Jeremy Corbyn factor in Britain was really fascinating to watch. And of course, although the right would like to think and the neoliberals would like to think that's all gone, Peter Mandelson and, you know, Keir Starmer and the rest of them, who really, and Tony Blair, by the way, who were behind the Starmer project to take over the Labour Party. What we may well see, I think, because there's so many people on the left, the former mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, obviously Corbyn himself, Chris Williamson, George Galloway, various of these other ex-Labour characters are getting their act together. And we saw this on the right. We saw this with the Tories and Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party. What can happen in this country, and I think probably will, is that you get a collection of a very strong amongst the public, but not maybe very powerful in Westminster, fringe party, which can move things in their direction. So I think this is actually what's likely to happen when Starmer gets to power, as I think he will next year, and proves to be so utterly useless, as he quite clearly is going to be, and actually quite dangerous. Then I think that's the moment at which the left will kind of re-Corbynise itself and start to push. It won't have parliamentary seats, but what it will have is a tremendous amount of sympathy both across the left and the right. Believe it or not, a lot of Tories support these Corbynistic, you know, the QE for the people. In other words, creating money and just giving it to people to spend to get the economy going. These kinds of policies are just common sense. And also renationalising a lot of the things that Thatcher sold off. These are very popular right across the board. So I think that's where the most important hopes lie. And this, of course, is where many of the bankers and security services are trying to infiltrate and control these groups, which may rise up in the next couple of years.
Okay. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me on the spotlight. We're out of time. Steve Kinn, economist and author out of Amsterdam. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist out of Bristol. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو ذا الرحمن
Allah
هو ذا المنان
لا إله إلا الله.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Karimi is the guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, every year, on the 40th day after the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, which is called the Day of Arba'in, so many people attend a kind of procession or walking towards the holy shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas, in the city of Karbala. Of course, this procession and one can be long and short, especially from Najaf to Karbala, for so many people from far places from Karbala. This walking on feet, you know, had so many hardships and afflictions for the people who are on this path towards Karbala. So now the main question is that, rationally speaking and according to the Islamic Sharia, is it allowed to tolerate and bear such hardships in order to take part in a walk toward the holy shrine of Imam al-Hussein or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we are talking about harming the body and whether it is prohibited in the religion of Islam or not, we need to distinguish between two kinds of harms. Sometimes it is a kind of what we call it considerable harm, meaning that it may cause to one's death or, I mean, serious injuries and diseases and so on and so forth. Yes, if we are talking about such damage, then it is prohibited. But sometimes we are talking about a kind of harm which is not unbearable and it is not considerable. It may bring you some difficulty, but people are able to bear it and stand it. So if you want to call the Arba'in walk to belong to the first category, it is not true. I mean, you hardly find any person who may lose his life for, I mean, this walk. Yes, there might be some exceptions. There might be, accidents and so on and so forth. And it can be anywhere, even in the pilgrimage to Hajj.
Yes.
But if we are talking about the second category, it is true that Arba'in walk may bring people some hardships and difficulties.
Yes.
But this kind of difficulty is absolutely, permitted in the religion of Islam. Otherwise, any kind of work and activity will bring you some problems and difficulty.
Yes.
Even playing football or exercising and doing any job, whatever, will bring you some difficulties and problems. Does it mean that every job is prohibited? Of course not.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one point. When it comes to the Arba'in walk, because there are some questions about why people walk from different cities,
yes,
toward the city of Karbala, we will talk maybe in another session independently about that. But especially for ziyarah of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, there are a number of narrations which encourage people to walk. And this is something rooted in the lifestyle and the seerah and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So, I mean, besides going to Karbala, we have some narrations according to